Welcome to today's Future of Leadership podcast. And as you know, we are talking with thought leaders around the globe about the leadership lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic and the shutdown. And today I'm really happy about having a very special guest to talk to. She is the James McGregor Burns Lecturer in Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. She's the founding executive director of the School Center for Public Leadership. She has held professorships in several universities, and she's author and editor of many books about leadership. For example, books like Bad Leadership, Followership, that was where we found her, you know, reading her ideas about leadership and followership, but also a book called Women and Leadership and The End of Leadership and many more. And she speaks and advises leadership teams around the world. And we had the honor to have her at our Future of Leadership conference twice. So welcome, Barbara Kellermann.
Hi there, Sebastian. It's great to talk to you again. I wish it were in person.
Yeah. Actually, the beer gardens just opened again in Bavaria, so it would be possible right now.
I'm in the wrong place, that's for sure.
And that's a pity. That's really a pity. Barbara, I mean, how has your daily business changed since the corona lockdown started? So what have been your personal experiences, and when did you become aware that this will become kind of a bigger thing and not kind of just a little flu?
Well, it's really a very interesting question that you're asking, Sebastian, because what we know now is how long it took most of us to grasp, because many political leaders around the world were not fully honest early on. This is not the case across the board, but in many countries around the world, including my own, the United States, it took a considerable time for the public really to be informed. We didn't really understand in January, and we really didn't understand much in February either. It was only toward the end of February that we started to understand the gravity of this situation and the fact that it really was not just a game changer, but a life changer for some period of time. And then by March, it became clear that we were not just in a public health crisis, but indeed in a financial crisis. So when I talk about this now, or I write about it, I am always talking about two separate, obviously totally related, but also separate and distinct crises or situations, which we honestly, I think nobody in their wildest dreams anticipated even a few months ago. So I think my life, like so many lives around the world, has been changed literally. That is, I'm working almost entirely from home as opposed to from my office at Harvard. But more to the point, I think it's a mental, you know, it's taken some time for us to become familiar with what is going on intellectually and psychologically. So, and to understand that the capacity to predict the future, whether this is, we're talking here about a vaccine in 6 months or in 12 months or in 18 months or in 3 years or therapeutics in some time frame, the lack of unanimity and agreement on how long medicine slash science will take before they can help us climb out of this, that remains, as you and I are talking, still entirely unclear.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I had the sentiment that there is a lot of ambiguous feelings, especially in the beginning, because it really was not so hard to decide, is it really just a flu? Because at least we knew that years ago, I mean, it was thousands of people that were also killed by a normal flu, or is it really something special? So it was really hard to understand, is this just a social dynamics and a hysteric driven by big data, because nowadays you have this real life charts where you can see things popping up whenever a new person, gets somehow infected? Or is it really a very serious situation? So how did you perceive that? And what is your judgment? Do you think that the global lockdown has been the appropriate manner to handle this corona pandemic or not?
You know, I think, Sebastian, you're asking the key question, but I think the answer to the key question will not be accessible to us for some time to come. Mm. There is no doubt, as you suggest, that technology, the media, social media, ordinary media, has played an enormous role in exacerbating our fears about this. Over 80% of the people who get the virus recover. And the people who have died have generally fallen, as you know, into certain categories. So, and at the same time, many more people die of cancer. Many more people die in car accidents. That's why I'm saying it's very hard to tell in the present moment whether 5 and 10 years from now, historians will look back and describe what's going on as an overreaction. Mm-hmm. Be that as it may, for leaders, and I know that is your primary population of concern, whatever sector, private sector, public sector, in Germany, in the United States, in Asia or Latin America, leaders have no choice but to grapple with where we are. Mm-hmm. The historians will be left to figure out whether it makes sense to be where we are, but it is up to the leaders as we sit here in toward the end of May to figure out how to proceed from this point on. And because we still know so little, my sense, at least in this country, and I think more globally, leaders, including in Germany, of course, leaders are trying now to find some balance between being willing to accept a certain amount of physical, that is public health risk, in the interest of getting the economy going again. So in my country, for example, Donald Trump, who has early on insisted that the country get back to work and generally been derided by most of the, not just the left, but the center, it's possible that in 5 years, his early admonition that we have to be careful not to tip so far over into concern over physical risk that we really demolish ourselves economically, that concern may be more well-founded than many people were able recently to appreciate.
I mean, actually, I thought it was very interesting for me to observe, that at least in Germany, there was the development that when people became aware that this coronavirus, is heavily spreading in Italy, in Bergamo area, so they became very nervous and concerned about their personal health because now the threat was very close. And then the politicians, at the beginning, they let the scientists on the stage in Germany and the people, the virologists, or however you call it, did I spell it right? Okay.
Yes, you did. Yes, it's good. It's good.
Like Mr. Drosten in Germany, and I think Mr. Fossey is the person in the United States. So they were listened very well, and the politicians more or less followed their instructions. And in Germany, there was a steep acceptance of the ruling governments. So the Christian Democratic Party went up like about 15 to 20% in the polls. So at the beginning, people were very excited or very supportive, and I from beginning said it's easier to make hard decisions at the beginning than to ease them later, because politicians, they know that they are in the media and they do not like bad news. So then to ease up these restrictive things, and then reading an article, people got infected because Mr. Politician XY, eased up the rules. that will not be easy. And this is exactly now my perception in Germany. Nobody really knows how this process back to normality goes, and everybody is hesitant to make decisions there. How do you observe this way of decision making, let's say?
Yeah, I you know, the German experience in the last in the first 5 months of 2020, the German experience and the American experience have been quite different. Mm-hmm. Germany has been more similar to countries such as Singapore and Taiwan and New Zealand. By the way, some of them led also by women, but that's a separate mm-hmm. conversation. Women have generally been thought to do better in this crisis mm-hmm. than men. Mm-hmm. But the American experience has been much more like the British experience. The national leaders have been very slow. I'm talking particularly about Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, who in the beginning shared Trump still has it, but in the beginning they shared a macho bravado. Boris Johnson said, until he became ill, he said, "Oh, I'm still shaking hands." Mm-hmm. And to this day, Donald Trump famously is refusing to wear a mask. Every other political leader is wearing a mask. The German experience, and I'm a bit of a student, as you know, of Angela Merkel, mm-hmm. certainly in the beginning was very different. Among other things, she is known to have been, in her early incarnation, herself a scientist, not a physician, but nevertheless trained in the sciences. And she also was willing, as you just said, in a way politicians in this country, certainly in the administration, were not early on, to listen to the experts. Mm-hmm. The present administration is quite unusual in that it has been very reluctant to listen to the people who have the expertise. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other question of, you know, what is the role of experts here mm-hmm. and what should experts do when the leaders don't listen to them, which is of interest to me because I'm always interested in good followership as mm-hmm. I am in good leadership. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what has happened up to now in our two countries, United States and Germany, has been different. But I agree with the implications of what you just said, which is, okay, up to now, the experience has been different. However, as we reach the end of May and we're beginning in June, the uncertainties as to how to strike the right balance between getting back to normal, which of course means above all economic normal, a fiscal normal, and still protecting the public health, the uncertainties about will there be a second wave in the fall? Will there be, as I said earlier, a vaccine and therapeutics? And if so, when? Those uncertainties we share. So, as I always say to my students, the thing about leadership that's so interesting is that there are, at the same time, both many commonalities and many differences. And I think the experience of Germany in the last few months vis-a-vis the United States in the last few months has that aspect to it. Very many differences, but as we sit here today, very many commonalities.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I had a discussion with a philosopher, and he, as a positive aspect, he said that this corona crisis or COVID-19 crisis at least showed that people around the world as a collective were showing a certain reason and understanding that there is a global crisis, and they were willing to react and change their behaviors in a certain way, more or less in most of the countries around the world. And he said this might be a positive sign, as there are many crises which have a global impact, that perhaps mankind is able to react with a certain reason when people understand that there is a threat. How do you interpret that? Or do you think it's just because people had the feeling, oh, I can get myself, and so it was a very direct threat, and it's not because they understood that, you know, others or the world or the mankind as one would be under danger?
I have a short answer for you, the second, not the first. In other words, I think your philosopher colleague might have had in mind climate change, something like that.
For example, this was exactly what we were talking about.
Yes, I suspected as much. That's what people who are rather more idealistic than I am. And I wouldn't say that if the climate crisis between hurricanes and flooding and rising sea levels threatens me and my home, as you're suggesting the coronavirus has, then our responses will be the same. But humankind, the human brain is very bad at acting in the present to stave off disaster in the future. Mm-hmm. It's why people have to be nudged to save for retirement. Certainly Americans do. I think that's less the case in Germany for various reasons, but it doesn't have to do with psychology. Mm-hmm. So no, I do not see this as an event that signifies a new global consciousness at all. I think certainly Americans have very poor idea of what's happening in other countries as usual. And our concern is our country and our community and our families. And it's quite tribal and it's quite immediate. And I would not translate this moment into some future kumbaya, let's all hold hands moment, not for one second. I'm quite cynical about that.
Hmm.
History does not suggest that this will be some kind of global awakening, at least not one that will endure for any length of time. There's no evidence in history. That's rather idealistic, and it would be lovely, but I'm not holding my breath.
But do you think that some kind of idealism at least is good for personal psychological health, or potentially?
Absolutely. I think we all hope and we all, I myself tend to optimism and not pessimism.
Yeah.
But I will say that the more I study, history, and I do think things change. But I don't think the human psyche changes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why we read Shakespeare or Goethe. Mm-hmm. Or Machiavelli. We read Shakespeare and Goethe and Machiavelli because hundreds of years ago they spoke about humankind in ways that resonate today. So I think humans today are rather the way they were 500 or even 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. And I think the context changes, but we essentially do not. And therefore, I'm not looking for some magical moment.
So I understand you in a way that you say, okay, it will not be human wisdom or insight, you know, that will change behavior across the world. But what could change behavior is that perhaps the world becomes smaller due to, you know, social media and the information flow. And, you know, that when in China you have a breakout of a pandemic within weeks due to the global connectedness, it will arrive somewhere in Europe. So do you think that still there is a tendency that global alignment to fight crisis has to become closer and will become stronger? Because I thought at least it was interesting that more or less all governments reacted in a very similar way to this current situation, or was that not the case? Is that just a wrong interpretation?
I think that with regard to globalization generally, I think there are short-term trends and long-term trends. Long-term, of course, I agree with you. We are globalized whether we like it or not. However, as I don't have to tell you as a European, short-term, if anything, this crisis has divided us and not brought us closer together. Mm. It's not clear how Europe or the EU is going to emerge from this period. Mm. We know that before the virus was upon us, there was Brexit, and Europe was having a hard time hanging together for various reasons, immigration being very high on the list, which some countries saw as an enormous threat. And they closed off their walls, and other, which Brexit in a way is a response to as well, of course. And since the crisis, a country such as the United States has become very concerned, above all, perhaps given the nature of the crisis, because of global supply chains. Mm-hmm. So the United States is now saying we are never again going to want to depend on China for any critical medical supplies. And I think many of those businesses will be brought back onshore after being offshore for many years because it was cheaper. Now I think people will be willing to pay an extra dollar for the mask if they know the damn mask is going to be available to them if they need it. So I think the short-term lessons that people have learned are relatively more nationalistic and protective, not conducive to globalization. Travel, I think, for some time will be down. In other words, both our countries have been examples of meccas of tourism and students coming to study by the thousands and thousands and thousands. That is going to end for some time. And that some time, instead of being 6 months, could be 6 years. As you and I are talking, we don't know when everyone is going to feel completely free again to jump on a plane and live elsewhere for a year or 4 years. So I think the short-term effects are not globalization, but I completely agree with the general point. The technology alone and the gradual intellectual recognition that whether it's a pandemic or climate change, we are in this together, that, of course, is again simultaneously true. Again, one of the wonderful things about studying leadership is that you have to hold in your head two contradict, often have to hold in your head two contradictory thoughts at the same time. So at the same time, there is increasing globalization, yes. And at the same time, there is increasing nationalization also, yes. They coexist. They are not mutually exclusive.
So this shows that one of the major leadership competences is really being able to cope with ambiguity and manage ambiguity.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, in Germany, we had these discussions about the WHO, the World Health Organization, and, you know, there are assaults that they are more or less very much influenced by either China or other people say by Bill Gates. I do not know if you have the same kind of theories in the United States, but here have been even demonstrations against Bill Gates and that he wants to impfen, I do not know the word, you know, people against the pandemic and wants to support the global pharma industry. How do you assess the role of the UN organization when it comes to solving or to be a voice in this kind of global crisis?
So I'm going to answer your question twice over because I am going to talk about the World Health Organization and I am also going to talk about Bill Gates since you raised his name and he's a very interesting figure right now. So with regard to the World Health Organization, in my country, as I'm sure in yours, every medical and scientific expert agrees it is imperfect. It has done things not so smart, especially in the early, again, in the early months of this year. At the same time, there is, the politicians don't agree, but the experts agree the world needs that World Health Organization. We cannot do without it. The United States, for the moment, because of Trump, has cut off support. It's perfectly idiotic. That's hopefully going to change when there's a new administration. If there's a new administration, we cannot do, again, we cannot, you know, as your earlier point about globalization, this is a global issue, as are many health issues, and we cannot do without an organization, imperfect as it is, such as the World Health Organization. And any other conversation is divisive and foolish. I'm going to make the same point about Bill Gates. I have recently written with a colleague a new book, which is coming out in maybe 2 months, called, it's being published by Cambridge University Press. It's called Leaders Who Lust.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is Power, Money, Sex, Success, Legacy, and Legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And Bill Gates is actually a character in that book. There is a discussion, an extended discussion, not only of Bill Gates, but of his wife, Melinda Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Because he and Melinda Gates have had for many years now a foundation, as you probably know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has had as its goal to pour money into it by the millions mm-hmm. and billions to eradicate certain diseases globally, such as polio and especially malaria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bill Gates, again, as you know, has had two lives, one as a computer expert and then as a leader in the computer industry, and the second as one of the world's leading philanthropists.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gates is one of the most exceptional people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that in this climate, in this day and age, he has also now become, because he is for the first time really visible in a new and different way in this very stressful climate, he has become a target, mm-hmm. above all, of conspiracy theorists.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Who think that, oh, he wants to develop a vaccine because he's going to, in the vaccine is going to be a microchip. And some percentage of people are saying, even when they have a vaccine, I'm going to refuse to take the vaccine. We live in a world, Sebastian, in which some minority, and it is a minority, but it is not a tiny minority,
mm-hmm.
not in Germany and not in the United States, has a mindset that is oriented toward conspiracies, that is highly suspicious of authority figures, of experts, even of scientific experts. So I think the majority will simply have to continue on its way, labor to, if not persuade this aggressive, loud minority, then at least to marginalize it so it does not control the majority, which is sensible and centrist.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in this country and certainly in Germany, there is a centrist, sensible majority, whether politically or scientifically or economically, mm-hmm. which we can only hope will in the long term prevail.
But they are not so loud. Especially not in a crisis situation. And actually, I mean, this is a little bit what I sometimes really, this was also a reason for this podcast, that when you read the news, you know, the news in this time, they do not really spread helpful information, but they spread kind of information that is creating fears or polarizing and stuff like this. So I think the media have, especially in crisis, it also a difficult role, because in the end they should help to make people calm and confident and really convey information that is really helpful to react in a reasonable way to the situation. But there's also the danger that they try to create some rumors and to foster things, because they know that people like it. What is your observation of the media?
Well, I'm going to comment somewhat more broadly in response to your question. I wrote a book a few years ago called The End of Leadership,
mm-hmm.
in which I argued that because of the changing culture, in which we have far less respect, ordinary people, for people in positions of authority,
mm-hmm.
For expertise. We feel much freer and much more liberated to be equal with anyone, no matter how high their station.
Mm-hmm.
That's a change that took place, that began in the late 20th century, that change in culture.
Mm-hmm.
In which when I started teaching and I would walk into a classroom, my students automatically called me Professor Kellerman or Dr. Kellerman. Mm-hmm. Now, when I walk into a classroom, they're just as likely to call me Barbara, even if I've never met them before. It's a small, it's a symbol mm-hmm. of this collapsing of the distance between people in positions of authority and ordinary people. Mm-hmm. So that started late in the 20th century, and it has aggressively continued into the 21st. The other major change is technology. The technology enables people who have no power and no authority and no real influence to scream and yell. They are encouraged by the media, as you correctly say, traditional media and new media. And so what has changed in the last 20, 30 years is not you and me, but the context within which people like you and me, ordinary people, are situated. Mm-hmm. So to go back specifically to leadership, I'm not sure, Sebastian, if you know this, but I never talk anymore or write anymore about leadership. Mm-hmm. I always frame everything, whether I'm writing or teaching, in terms of the leadership system. Mm-hmm. The leadership system has three parts. It's a little more complicated than the leader-centrism on which we normally fixate. But it has only three parts. Leaders, they're very important. It's not to minimize them. Hmm. Followers, everyone else, which is, you know, a wholly other conversation between us, not for today. And contexts. Hmm. And what we are, the reason we're having this conversation today is not because leaders particularly have changed or because followers even particularly have changed, but because the context has become dominated by the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. For better and worse, whether legitimately or not. And that is forcing every leader, every person in a position of authority, whether in the private sector, the public sector, whether in Germany or in the United States, wherever, in some way to respond. Mm-hmm. So this emphasis on context, on if I teach my students anything, it is to try to focus less on themselves, less leader skills and leader self-awareness and authenticity. Mm-hmm. I try to take the attention away from the leader because there's enough attention on the leader anyway, and put much more attention on followers or on everyone else, whatever mm-hmm. word you want to use, but also especially on the context. Mm-hmm. Our lack of contextual awareness, contextual intelligence, contextual expertise has been very damaging. And in fact, to return to the coronavirus crisis, there have been people, by the way, including Bill Gates, but there have been people who have been warning about such a virus, mm-hmm. such a pandemic for years. Mm-hmm. But because we don't teach our leaders to pay attention, we don't train them properly how to really navigate the context, they have been almost overwhelmingly ill-prepared. So here we find ourselves mm-hmm. in a place that we didn't have to be had we acted more swiftly and smartly early on, and even now are very unsure, as we said earlier, about where to go next.
Barbara, that was very, very interesting and insightful. And actually, I just thought that it's really true, you know, that a certain respect to people in authority should be still there, because sometimes I tell to people, you know, we had this discussion last year when Angela Merkel, sometimes in the public, she started to
tremble.
To tremble. And then people said, oh, she's becoming old or whatever. And I said, can you imagine how you would feel when the whole public global attention would be focused on you? I mean, most people, especially male people, one of their biggest concern is to hold free speeches in front of an audience. So I think you should really respect when people are willing to stand out and to be seen and even a person in a situation like Donald Trump and whatever is his mindset, it's a totally different story. But I think the energy that he needs to handle all this attention that he gets. For sure, he wants to have this attention, but it's amazing. I think many people would not survive that in a way. So I think this kind of having a certain respect to people that are willing to take responsibility should be there. Even the followers get more and more kind of a heavy weight in such processes. But now coming to kind of the last question, when you talk to your students at Harvard University, and they would ask you, okay, what will be different from before after this Corona shutdown? So what can we really learn, or what will be different? What would you have to kind of accept in the long run as changes or as things where we have to change our mindset, or our behavior? What would you say will be, or do you see any large changes that you can predict right now, or that you think will last for longer from this?
Yeah, I would say there is one, and this is, I'm saying something that has been said many times before now, but it's a very, very significant, so I'm simply going to repeat it, because it has implications for leadership, mm-hmm. and that is the nature of work. Mm-hmm. I do think, again, this is a contextual change. This is about context. Mm-hmm. You know, in developed countries, as you well know, for decades and decades, people have been used to getting up in the morning and taking some form of transport, generally, especially, you know, people who hold regular jobs. And they take some form of transport and they go to a place of work. Mm-hmm. For middle-level bureaucrats, middle-level managers, et cetera, white-collar workers, this place of work has been an office, which is generally located in an urban setting, even downtown in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. That seems to me, for some period of time, look, people love cities. Since the time of the Greeks and the Romans, people gravitate, and before, human history has people congregating in cities. We love cities. We like cities. But we are also have started to recognize, both the employee and the employer has started to recognize, the benefits of not having someone come into a workplace 5 days a week from 8 or 9 in the morning until 6 or 7 or whatever it is at night. I have no doubt this change is permanent to an extent. It doesn't mean everybody's going to be working from home all the time. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that cities are going to be dead. But I can predict with some considerable certainty that a city such as San Francisco, for example, the cluster of technology that was in the Palo Alto area outside of San Francisco, and where rents had been driven sky high in recent decades, and middle class and lower class people were being driven out because of the density of demand, that is going to ease, because those people are going to leave. And places like Facebook, places like Twitter, have already said to their employees, you don't just have permission to work from home until Labor Day or until Christmas. You have permission to work from home indefinitely. This is going to be a sea change in the nature of work indefinitely, not just for the coronavirus crisis. Mm-hmm. And leaders and managers, if I were advising leaders and managers, which to some degree I do, I would say this is the single trend that we can point to that we can say will be to some extent permanent. Because it's saving everybody time and trouble, and it's saving the employer, instead of having to rent at sky high prices commercial real estate in the heart of Midtown Manhattan or the heart of Midtown Düsseldorf or whatever, they are going to be able to cut their costs because people will not be there. The entire workforce will not be there full time. So this has implications for leading and managing that we can talk about in another conversation.
Barbara, just a very last question. Do you think that this coronavirus will also have an impact on the elections in the United States, or how much is it dominating, you know, the presidential campaign
right now? Well, already, you know, the presumed Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, has essentially been locked in his house for the months and has said very little. I think that's about to change somewhat. Trump, meanwhile, of course, is front and center all the time. But interestingly, by saying very little, almost nothing for months, Biden's numbers in the polls keep going up and up and up.
Really?
It's not as if he has demonstrated any particular wisdom or intelligence. It's just that Trump, every time he opens his mouth, says something that is objectionable. I don't want to get too much into the politics of it, but his being in a highly visible leadership role in recent months, shall we say, has not helped him. The big question, Sebastian, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about November, is not about the impact of the coronavirus on the election, but it is the degree to which the election will be fair and carried out with a reasonable modicum of legal behavior. In this country, there is, for example, a huge debate about the virtues or deficits of casting your ballot by mail. The Democrats in general want people to be able to cast their ballot by mail. The Republicans in general, especially Donald Trump, do not want such a thing. But the question, again, will be between mail ballots and hacking from outsiders. Will the election be seen as a legitimate election? That's going to be the key question in November, not the impact of one or another thing, although that impact, of course, as you suggest, is considered.
Barbara, it has been, as always, a pleasure talking to you. You have helped me understanding the context better in many ways. I think this is a big strength of you, and this is always, for me, a real joy listening to your thoughts. So all the best and stay healthy.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye, Barbara.